You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 432 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we're coming to you from back in the home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
Right in Washington.
I guess, yeah, I didn't actually say that.
You said it like we were coming to you from back in.
Yeah, we're back. NFL season is back. By the time you listen to this, it will be the day of the first game. So here we go. If you haven't already, I don't know if you should listen to the Seahawks preview necessarily before this. This one's a little more time sensitive, I guess, than that. So listen to this, complete this first, then go back and circle back to that. But Ben Baldwin of RBSDM.com, great as always.
You and Ben are not excited enough about the Seahawks. It's like two people trying to like mirror each other on just who could be more neutral.
Like I said, I was so much more ready to buy in before the Abe Lucas news seemed as bleak as it currently does. Like, if Abe Lucas were healthy, I'd be, you know, top 10 offense, league average defense, like 9-8 at minimum. Let's go.
How very neutral of you.
That is optimistic. They're a team with a line of 7.5 wins. I didn't invent the expectations for the 2024 Seahawks.
What makes a man turn neutral? Lust for gold? Power? Or are you just bored with a heart full of neutrality? That's you and Ben. I hate those neutrals.
I mean, first off, we've already had a bit about me being the neutral on this podcast. I don't know if you forget.
I hate these filthy neutrals. That is me in the podcast with you and Ben. I'm sorry, but this team is going to be amazing.
Okay.
And there is literally not a doubt in my mind that the Seahawks are going to win 10 games and be awesome.
I said this earlier to you about your youngest son being his fantasy genius and how he's ready to be hurt again by the Eagles after drafting Jalen Hurts in the third round.
Oh, Mr. Over on the Eagles, right? Weren't you and Ben both over?
No.
Oh, well, no. I take that back. Were you both under?
They
was I over?
Pickering wins last year. The stats hate the Eagles. Very down on the Eagles. I didn't. In fact, I made under my lock for the Eagles. You could not be farther from it. I mean, I know we recorded it almost 26 hours ago, so 27 hours ago, so you may have forgotten, but yes, very hard on the Eagles. That's you about the Seahawks, though. You are straight up ready to get hurt again.
With enemies, you know where they stand. But with neutrals, who knows? It sickens me.
You know, it really makes a lot of noise when you grasp the microphone while you're talking into it.
Oh, it's not sorry. A traditional move. You're literally holding a microphone.
Yeah, but I'm not.
Sorry, not a balls can be as neutral as you are with regards to holding the microphone.
Not caressing the microphone.
Anyway, speaking of neutrals, Seattle Mariners. Now,
the Mariners picked the funniest time to score 16 runs. I did enjoy this note from Alex Meyer as part of his game-winning stat. It was the first 16-3 final ever in baseball at whatever the hell they call the Oakland Coliseum these days.
Okay.
And there was only one 16-3 score ever in football at the Coliseum.
There we go.
Which was an AFC championship game won by the Ravens. Well, I think we're going to do this week, oops, all Husky toasts.
Okay.
Because the only toasts I have are about UW football, and we can use this, I think, is a way to discuss the season opening, the Jed Fish era opening win over Weber State on Saturday, 35-3.
Oh, hello. You know who's not neutral? The University of Washington and Jed Fish. And especially Jonah Coleman. Should we start with that toast?
I was fully not neutral during that game as I was cheering for the Huskies. I do wonder, you know, how long the Jed Fish era is going to last. But that's a topic for another day.
Oh, my God. People are so concerned about things. If there's the number one quality of human beings is just being concerned about all things.
I agree.
You think Jed Fish? Let me just tell you right now, Florida's not that good of a job.
I agree.
What about the University of Florida job, where they didn't go and get a major head coach the last time? All of a sudden, it's like, well, now, if Jed Fish has a good year at UW, Jed Fish is bigger than Florida.
Well, what if Jed Fish has a neutral year at UW?
Then he's probably not that exciting to Florida.
Okay. We'll see.
The two options are Jed Fish is good at UW, and then Jed Fish, if he actually wants another job, can look beyond Florida.
I agree that, I mean, Florida just may be higher on his list than you think it is.
We lost our coach last year to the number one program in the country.
I'm not disputing that. Florida is a better program than you, Tristan Garasino, think it is.
Sure it is, but it has been a while. And also, it is not that easy of a place to win. It is consistently getting harder. I mean, you could probably say the same thing about the Big Ten, but it is consistently getting harder to win at Florida.
I mean, I suppose so.
The SEC is not getting easier.
People always say this, but like,
but then the one time Urban Meyer is good for a short period of time.
The teams they're playing against are in the SEC. It can't be getting harder for everyone. It can only be getting easier, harder for some schools.
What
it's
a
getting
neutral take
for
of you.
I mean, it's just you're like, oh, it's all of a sudden getting so much easier for Washington State and Oregon State.
It is.
I mean, they're probably going to win more games. I don't know what that translates into. Your chances of winning a championship.
Wazoo and Oregon State have a higher chance of making the college football playoff today than they did a year ago. And you know that.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, they do, because there's 12 teams in it now instead of four.
I mean, yes.
Mathematics.
But had Oregon State and Washington State been in, if the Pac-12 doesn't change at all, they have a higher chance now post 12-team Pac-12 era, because they're still in the Pac-12.
Correct.
But since post 12-team Pac-12 era, they have a higher chance of making the playoffs than they did.
I have no idea how to evaluate this, because we have never seen a 12-team playoff, what the makeup is going to look like, percentage of schools are going to come from the Big Ten and the SEC, let alone the other two remaining traditional power conferences.
It's just going to be less important also. Like,
yes,
that's kind of the reality of it. There are going to be teams every year where we look back 2 years later and we're like, that team, like Michigan State made the playoff. That wasn't a 4-team playoff. We already
no,
do
Michigan
it.
State didn't make the playoff, did they?
I believe Michigan State made the playoff.
I know they were in a CFP bowl game, but I don't
heard
know
if... you wouldn't even believe this. The last 2 years in the playoff, TCU and the University of Washington played in the national championship game.
It still shocks me.
Hard to believe. The TCU National Championship is just like, who let that happen?
Max Duggan. Is he still backing up for the Chargers? Did he make the team? I don't know. I didn't catch that one. Let's see here. Yeah, they won their bowl game. So by definition, they were not in the college football playoff.
I swear Michigan State made a playoff appearance. Am I wrong about that?
They were 10th in the final college football playoff rankings, so no, you were not close to it.
There's some team that I'm thinking of then that is just like, they made a playoff?
Yeah, I don't know.
Huh, okay.
Anyways, we start with congrats to Jonah Coleman, who becomes... Hello. I mean, we can toast to Jed Fish on his first win as UW head coach. But a congrats to Jonah Coleman. He became the first UW player to rush for 100 yards in his Husky debut since JC transfer Ronnie Rowland in 1976.
Now, do you remember Ronnie Rowland's game?
I really don't. I was -6 at the time.
Jonah Coleman's a beast. Jonah Coleman, I literally said this to Katie going in. Katie was poo-pooing everything on the face of the earth, as she does, because people are just so concerned about things.
Well, Katie's not a neutral. She's a negative.
She's not a filthy neutral. Katie was poo-pooing everything, being negative about all things. And I was just like, Jonah Coleman is a dog in every way, right? It was underrated, the transfer of Jonah Coleman to the University of Washington, because we were so focused on Fifita and McMillan. Whereas like that, it was a three-headed monster at Arizona between those three players. And obviously, would we have been excited? I mean, the Tetero McMillan line was like, would have liked that 300 yards.
Oh, I didn't see that. He had three. Who did they play? Like Northern Arizona?
I believe he had 300 yards or close to it. But wait, what was it? Yeah, 304 receiving yards.
Who did they play, though?
Would have taken it.
That's surprisingly difficult for you to find out. 10 catches for 304 yards. Oh, this week they face Northern Arizona, as they traditionally do at some point during non-conference play.
Not New Mexico. Wait, what team was that?
Again, this is taking
you
way too long to figure out.
But Jonah Coleman was a significant part of that attack. And you see him and you're just like, him, Adam Muhammad also, these are built dudes, right? I mean, you have to kind of give credit to Arizona's strength and conditioning that they had at the program also, which I think has been a focus of Jed Fish as well. But
That was against New Mexico. They gave up 39 points. That's what
I
was going to say.
I thought that was New Mexico just looking at the helmet.
Yeah, but they did score 61 on offense. Fifita went 19 of 31 for 422 yards and four touchdowns.
That's still Jed Fish's offense, for what it's worth.
Everybody but Tetro McMillan did not contribute as much as it was receiving. But yeah, that worked out pretty well. 10 catches, 304 yards, four touchdowns for McMillan.
Not super concerned what anybody else did when one of the players had 300 yards.
I know. It's a joke. The state of the UNLV running game looks strong. We didn't see Muhammad until the late third quarter when he came in along with Damon Williams Jr.
He's going to be awesome.
Second here, but yeah, he is. He does not look like a freshman. He's built like a tank. There's no other way to say it. And was very effective when he got in there. Granted, against fatigued and outmatched Weber State defense.
But. So Jonah Coleman averaged basically 8 yards per carry. There was also a long carry that was called back, a very long carry that was called back for hold,
yeah.
Right? Jonah Coleman had a massive game. It's all Weber State, and we can asterisk all this conversation because of that, but...
Well, we don't need to... The question is Jonah Coleman good? Like, we have ample evidence that Jonah Coleman is good. The question is the offensive line, and the offensive line, we couldn't learn against Weber State that they are going to be very good. We could have learned that the offensive line was going to be bad.
Exactly.
And we have taken that off the table for now.
3 short years ago, you were at the University of Washington watching this. I was at home.
That is correct.
This team lost to Montana.
It is a true fact.
So... whatever happened, you just can't take for granted this game. Maybe we shouldn't get too excited about it or whatever, but...
remain neutral.
I'm not going to. I'm putting this team in the playoff right now, so...
So will they match up against Washington State and Oregon State along the way?
In the playoff?
Yeah.
No, I don't think they're going to be a high enough seed. I mean, maybe if they're like 5-12... anyway,
people will really be anticipating that rematch against Washington State. Could be the only chance to play the Cougars at Husky Stadium or in Pullman this season.
Will Rogers took a couple of sacks in the game, but they weren't really offensive line sacks.
I was kind of surprised that Jed Fish was so critical of those. I haven't watched the replay of it in real time from our vantage point in the East End Zone. They looked like...
He was critical of the line, or he was critical of
Rogers.
It felt like, and he got dinged for it in QBR also.
Although maybe he was saying to take the hit as opposed to just kind of like give himself up in that situation, because it looked like situations where there were free rushers just because of the design of the play.
Yeah, and it's week one. They're still figuring out the offense right now. They're figuring out what works. Stuff like that is going to happen. But when you have a 20 for 26 with a brand new quarterback, he got the ball downfield also. It was less of a dinking and dunking offense than I think we thought it was.
Yeah, I mean, I think Will Rogers changed my opinion to a degree in the spring game with his ability to push the ball down the field. And we saw that again, I think, in this opener.
There was, who is the back shoulder catch to? Giles Jackson, is that who caught it? They definitely pounded the ball to Denzel Boston. They got the ball downfield to Denzel. I thought the offense...
Well, Damon Williams Jr. got the ball downfield to Denzel Boston, right?
And the long completion that was completely designed to Decker DeGraff, right?
Yep.
The play where I was like, oh my God, why doesn't the... It was like they were going to the left, and I was like, why is the ball not over there? And then Will Rogers looks to his right, and boom, there's a wide open Decker DeGraff for a touchdown. I mean, it was an awesome play call. And it felt like they just sort of waited a little bit. They got comfortable. This was a lot of these players' first time playing at Husky Stadium. It's the first game of the year. Offensively... it wasn't a 10 out of 10 offensively. It was like an 8 out of 10 offensively. But for your first game to be there for these players, I think this team is... They weren't 100% polished, but they are a lot more polished than I think people realized. And the line to me wasn't... it was unnoticeable. And I think that's what we wanted from the line.
I would agree that that's a positive. And the hold that was called on that long Jonah Coleman cutback, it was not actually a lineman. It was Quentin Moore, who later went out of the game with an injury. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Yeah, I mean, The local media made a lot of Jed Fish saying afterwards, I hope this is, you know, we want this to be our worst game of the year.
Yeah.
And that mantra. It's like, okay, that doesn't mean, like, therefore it's their worst performance relative to the opponents, because the other teams are going to get better over the course of the season. And in terms of competition, are going to get much better.
Every coach should say that, though. You always want the next game to be the best game because you have things to learn from the previous game. It's not necessarily going to happen, but your goal is always to have been the worst game.
What I'm saying is
to
expect that from a process standpoint, it may be to be their worst game, not from a results standpoint.
Yeah, I think that's fair also. I mean, of course it's their worst game process-wise. It's the first game of the year.
Hopefully it'll be the only time where they have to take a timeout because they can't figure out whether they need the punt return team out there or the field goal coverage team. Anyways, after the Huskies had taken a sizable lead in this one, congrats to Damond Williams Jr., who became the first true freshman to throw for a touchdown in the opening game in his debut in program history. Kind of a remarkable statistic, all things considered. We had an extended conversation about this where I reminisced about Jake Locker's first game as a redshirt freshman and only later realized that you said Jake Browning, who did start his first game as a true freshman at Boise State but did not throw for a touchdown in that game.
So offensively, I wanted to look back at, and statistically it's kind of a monster, but to look back at Kalen DeBoer's first game at UW, 45-20 against Kent State, right? That was the first game of the year?
Sure.
Penix was pretty incredible in that game. Had an 86 QBR, 4 touchdowns, 345 passing yards, 26 of 39. Honestly, when you look at it overall, like yards per attempt, it's about the same. Will Rogers was a little bit better. QBR was worse for Rogers because he didn't have the touchdowns. And then because also the sacks that he took, I think he got very much dinged on those. And Penix had 4 carries for 27 yards, which, you know, QBR loves a running quarterback.
I do know that.
So that might not be Will Rogers' game. In that game, do you know how many catches Roma Dunze had?
Like 5?
1 catch for 4 yards.
Okay.
So, again, there might not
this
be...
This is why...
Or, sorry, that was carries. Never mind, I take that back. He was 7 for 84.
Okay.
I was like, wow, that's kind of crazy. He was 7 for 84. Jalen McMillan, 5 for 87. Jalen Polk, 3 for 45. But the main takeaway that I had watching this offense was they look kind of the same.
Yeah, there was a moment in the first half where I was like, they haven't run enough play action yet. And then immediately, I think that may have been the touchdown to Decker DeGraff, which I think was off of play action and a bootleg. Things are fine. Everything is solid with the
unit. I think things are more than fine, though. And I think the reason things are more than fine is not even because of the offense. I think it's the other side of the ball.
Yeah, I mean, that's where, again, it's tough to say against Weber State. You hold Richie Munoz, who we talked about, him coming in as a starter at the end of last season, obviously, against FCS competition, but some very good FCS competition.
They beat Idaho at the end of last year. And there are a lot of people in the state of Oregon and the team from down south who would argue that Idaho is maybe one of the best teams in the country.
I don't know if they'd go that far necessarily. But they held him to under 100 yards, struggled to complete passes. I thought the coverage looked very strong. Thaddeus Dixon, I've been a longtime believer in. He locked down his side of the field. Ephesians Prysock got called for a questionable pass interference call, but locked down his side of the field.
Ephesians was amazing. The secondary looks incredible right now. Again, it's Weber State. If you want to be neutral about it, you can. This was a complete domination from this defense. He's 11 of 32. Like, to throw that many incompletions in 2024, it is hard in the sport of football.
Challenge accepted.
But for you, maybe. There are not that many games across the country that you could look at that you would see somebody have 21 incompletions and only 11 completions.
Probably not.
The line got pushed around maybe a little bit more than we would have liked.
I mean, again, without like watching closely in real time, whether it was the line getting pushed around or, you know, not strong enough run fits from your second level, that's very difficult to say. I mean, that probably looked more consistent with the Husky defense that we've seen the last couple of years. But you know what? It's not that important to be good at rushing defense relative to passing defense.
I mean, I'll be honest, there's a place we're going. There's a place we've gotten to where it is more important.
I don't know if I would say it's more important. I mean, yes, when Michigan runs for multiple long touchdowns in the first quarter of the
I think it's going to matter more.
College football playoff championship, that's a problem.
But the defense overall, the thing that I took away from it was that it felt very Belichickian. And it was one of those games where you're like, they're moving the ball. They're kind of moving the ball every drive, sort of. And you don't feel like it's a domination when you're there until all of a sudden you look up and Richie Munoz is 11 for 32 and Weber State is under 100 passing yards and they've scored 3 points in here in the fourth quarter. Or they'd scored 0 points for much of the game.
Right.
And it was one of those games. That is not what happened to this UW defense last year. The UW defense last year was not very good overall. And that was the kind of team where you're just like, can you just get one fucking stop? Please. Can you just get a stop? And
I mean, depends on the offense you were going against, but yes.
And in the important moments, they ended up getting those. But like, we're kind of forgetting just how lucky that UW team was a year ago.
We're not forgetting.
Many people, I think, when they've dinged this current UW team, they...
I don't think it's even when they ding this current UW team. It's just that in the romanticized retelling of 2023, it was inevitable that they were going to win all these games and be undefeated until the championship.
We were there at Stanford. They probably should have lost. Wasn't there like a penalty against Stanford on the last drive that they would have picked it up? And
I don't remember that specifically.
That was the one that we were watching on Halloween, right? That was Stanford.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I guess so. I don't remember the penalty.
I mean, they should have won that game. There were a lot of these games. Wazoo probably should have won. Cam Ward, if I think Cam Ward pulls down the ball and runs. Honestly, like even beating Cam Ward now, I'm like, it was a pretty good dub. But there were many games that they should have lost last year, and the defense didn't.
Cam Ward weirdly hurt his chances of going to the playoff by going to Miami.
No, he increased his chances of going to the playoff.
No, he should have been at Washington State.
Oh, no. Have you looked at that Miami schedule? They're going to
cakewalk
to the playoff. But Alfonso Tubatala led the team in tackles, controlling the defense, running the defense from that middle linebacker spot. It was awesome to see. It was interesting that there were no turnovers in this game, and I think that's probably how you end up with a 35-3 score rather than something even more lopsided. But like, there wasn't a ton of... It didn't feel like there was a ton of luck involved in what they did.
No.
Right? There weren't bounces that went their way. It was kind of the opposite. And they still held that team to 3 points. Like, this was an impressive defensive performance. And I think from this point forward, again, whether they give up more points sometimes than they did last year, because they might be facing some better offenses, I think this defense statistically is going to be significantly better than they were a year ago.
I don't know about significantly better, but I do think they will be better.
And if the offense is anywhere near what they were, sign me up. Like, how about this? Is your perspective of this Husky team changed after the Weber State victory?
It's moderately more positive.
There we go.
It is not neutral. I mean, they beat the spread.
They covered the spread.
What I would say is, look, 2024, I don't want to say it doesn't matter.
It matters. I hate that people are saying it doesn't matter. That's what they said about Kalen DeBoer 2 years ago, about Kalen DeBoer's first season.
I don't think anyone did say that. His starting quarterback was a senior, fifth-year senior. Like, and Will Rogers is, but
he
like,
wasn't there a fifth-year senior. He played 2 years here. You're saying because he got a COVID year?
Yeah.
It is not, there's not enough time at a program to worry about program building in the transfer era.
I mean, maybe not, but
if you're taking over unwin Arizona, then sure.
What I'm trying to tell you is I think the most exciting drive of the game, it was seeing Damon Williams Jr. and Adam Muhammad lead the offense down the field.
I don't agree with you.
I mean, first off, from a drive perspective, I don't know if any single drive was as impressive by the offense, even if you want to say the
drive to Rogers begin the second well. Half.
Oh, the one where they got backed up by the penalty on the kickoff?
And just marched downfield.
Yeah, I guess that's a fair point.
This was the best drive of the game. Where is it?
Really, you're still looking at Arizona's schedule. Still haven't figured
12
out.
Plays, 90 yards?
Yeah.
12 plays, 90 yeah, yards, they were backed 5:55. Up at the 10.
All right, yeah, that's a fair point.
Picked up a 3rd and 1, picked up a 3rd and 4. Kind of just bang, 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 down the field. They ran the ball. They passed the ball. I mean, Jonah Coleman going for 25 yards in the first two plays. Just like, come on, sign me up. Also, love DJ, love Dylan Johnson. Jonah Coleman is better.
Oh, yeah.
Jonah Coleman is a Sunday running back. And I know Jonah Coleman has another year of eligibility. If we want to be nervous about people leaving, it shouldn't be Jed Fish. It's Jonah Coleman. because he is the engine of this offense. And that also is another piece heading to the Big Ten. Having a running back be your focal point is huge. So I don't know. I'm freaking hyped on this team right now. I feel great about it. Seeing them play defense, like, it was funny where I was like, when was the last time you saw the Huskies play defense? And I'm like, Chris Peterson's teams played very good defense.
Yeah. It's not that long ago.
But it just, we're seeing the things. And again, I'm actually curious to talk about Eastern Michigan and see how much of an upgrade. Not an upgrade?
Not that much. It'll be an upgrade, but not that much. FPI actually gives them a higher chance of winning this week.
Do you think that's because of the opponent, or FPI thinks more positively of the Huskies?
The Huskies did move up 5 spots in FPI to number 26.
Okay. About where they were in the polls. They were 25th, I believe, in the coaches' poll.
They were, you know, disrespected. 33rd, 8th also receiving. They dropped in the AP poll.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
How is that possible?
I mean, I'm sure some other teams had more impressive week one victories in that range, but it was a surprising outcome, I would say. But yeah, we'll get to that at the end of the pod as we preview Seahawks Broncos.
I don't know yet. I think this stretch right here, the last one was Damon Williams, right? But they go into the half 14-0, right? The game is basically over and we know it, but they needed that drive and it's like, boom, touchdown. 3 plays, 1 yard, boom, touchdown. And then they hit the field goal and in comes Damon Williams.
Yep.
So, you know, Jed Fish was not worried about running up the score against Weber State. They could have won by more if they wanted to, but those three drives consecutively, but the 2 drives that Will Rogers had back to back in the second half were foot on the throat, like end the game type drives. So
that's fair.
I thought it was awesome all around. I'm just excited to watch Jonah Coleman play football now.
It also was like
running backs do matter.
One of the most, our view from the east end zone, we don't get to see the water. So to see this, like the haze, the afterglow of the sunset with this 8 p.m. kickoff on Labor Day weekend, it was about as nice as a game viewing experience can possibly get.
And what we're going to see this Saturday is the sweat dripping down our faces.
Oh, no. Yeah. I haven't looked at the forecast.
A very different kind of atmosphere. Mm-hmm.
Build the dome specifically just for us.
Yeah, just because we think it'd be helpful. Anyway, I loved every second of it. It was great. I was reminded again. I mean, we still had sort of the memories of the past, right? We hadn't been to Husky Stadium since the Apple Cup, and a lot happened since then.
Yeah.
Positive and negative. But the people next to us had a book that they'd gotten for Christmas of memories of the 2024 season, which is just like, oh my God, that game. It was very fun to see and look back on and the instant nostalgia of it. And one of the people who sits next to us, he sits with his dad and he was like, that book is like the most cherished thing for him. And I'm like, that's the kind of year we had. Is if you've been a season ticket holder stretching back to the 80s, 2023 was the season that you're looking at. And that's what you feel so amazing about. And obviously there's 91, but I think we kind of look at it and it's like 91, 2023, those two seasons.
Well, without question.
So
I mean, I put the 2000 season up there for me personally.
There were other ones also. I mean, 2016, 2000, like there were other seasons in there, but it's unfortunate that the 2000 season didn't happen in a playoff era.
It would have been real interesting. They would have had a rematch against Miami. Should we return to our search for Seattle's best cookie?
It's been a while.
Today, I was finally able to pick up Cookies with Tiffany. And it's Cookies with Tiffany as opposed to Cookies by Tiffany, according to their website, to emphasize the power of building community. This location opened during the pandemic after the founder lost her job as COO of a local culinary company. They have a shop in Madrona that's open Thursday to Sunday afternoon, evening, and then are also downtown at the U.S. Bank Center Tuesdays and Wednesdays, which is where I made this pickup. And also at T-Mobile Park, and apparently is of last week in Husky Stadium. So we need to do some research on where in the stadium we can get Cookies with Tiffany.
I walked the entire stadium and didn't see any Cookies with Tiffany.
All right, we'll continue.
It was just pacing around with Katie.
It was all frozen lemonade. That's all you saw. All you saw was purple lemonade. No Dojo anymore, sadly. Also, note here, Cookies with Tiffany gives back to the community. With every purchase of a celebration cookie, we give a percentage of sales to children receiving treatment at Seattle Children's. And with every purchase of a s'more cookie, we give a percentage of sales to the Swedish Cancer Institute. So that was, the s'more was one of what we got. I picked up a chocolate chip for each of us, and then a s'more and a cookies and cream, which is the seasonal for us to split.
Okay, the cookies and cream was the one with the Oreos on it?
Yep.
All right. What did we think?
So they're a little flatter than I think is my preference for a cookie. Like that's the one thing I'm really coming back to is I do think there is, your ideal shape of a cookie is a little different than mine, but there definitely is one, and mine is thick.
Two C's. Kevin Pelton likes a big booty cookie. Not neutral about that.
No.
I thought they were pretty great, to be honest. If I had to ding them in any way, it would be they kind of taste a little bit like, not taste necessarily, the texture profile was kind of like if I was making cookies at home and I undercooked them properly. But like, those are great cookies that I'm...
They are great cookies.
When you make those.
And
so.
I guess you did once do your own version of the Macklemore.
So I am kind of like, that's not even a complaint. That's just a... It wasn't so unique that you could be like, okay, cool, this is what this is.
And there were some other flavors that I didn't try that I stuck with, kind of the more reliable ones.
The Saint Bread cookie, it was special. The treat cookie, you see a treat cookie, you know what you're getting, right? Hello Robin, you taste it, you could taste the butter, right? It stands out. But at the same time, I thought these were phenomenal cookies, and I personally would be happy to have them in the bracket.
Okay. Well, we'll have to think about this when we decide exactly how large this sprawling this bracket is going to be.
64 teams.
Which I've been thinking...
68 teams.
Maybe if we do plan to do a live podcast again in the spring, we should wait and have the bracket in the spring. But the counter argument is search for Seattle's best pho.
I'm down for pho.
Long awaited. So
I mean, we could have two searches that we conclude.
It is possible. We're gonna continue to monitor that situation.
But at the same time, when you mentioned this is what really matters about a food item, a cookie, whatever. When you were like, they have these cookies at Husky Stadium, I thought to myself, well, where are those?
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh, okay, that's fine. You know? You're like, they have Ivers at Husky Stadium. I'm like, okay.
So that puts it at least at a one star. I don't know. Oh, yeah. Or one Pelton Caspi. I don't know which, you know, even to us, the star system is nebulous.
Even to us. I don't know it at all. That's not to you.
But we're certainly happy to detour within Husky Stadium.
I know we're locked in. We're dialed in.
There are multiple locations in T-Mobile Park, though. And
I don't think I've seen it.
I've heard from people who have gotten them. So
my goal is to never set foot in that place ever again.
Wow. Well, spoiler alert for
unless Billy Joel's coming back, I won't be there.
You weren't there for Billy Joel the first time,
but just the next time, Billy Joel.
You heard about the experience from Jan and me. And
I got like, offered Foo Fighters tickets, and I was just like, "No, thank you. I do not choose to step foot in that stadium." Cursed.
Well, for those of you who are continuing to set foot in T-Mobile Park, check out Cookies with Tiffany.
I do not recommend it.
I'm going next week. It'll be my first game of the season.
Wait, really?
I am.
That's your first game of the season?
It sure is. I have
been
to
so many Mariners games.
How many Mariners games have you been to?
Probably like 10.
Really?
Nah, maybe not that many. No, I feel like it's probably pretty close to that.
You're getting Diamond Club tickets all the time. Some of us are quite so lucky.
I went to a Cubs game with the children, the Phillies game. Two times in Diamond Club, maybe five times.
Okay, that's substantially different than 10, but yes, that is a good number.
And then I can't remember why I was in another game. Five to maybe six. Too many times. And you know what? I can't get that time back. The Mariners have taken that from me, just like they took my...
Okay. What? We'll get to them in a second.
The $18 per month that I spent on Root Sports, I went on to the Comcast website and I tried to change my plan on Saturday. This is how visceral it is. I was like, I choose to never see another Mariners game again.
It is a good idea because at this point that doesn't
get you. I
think
I've probably like paid through the rest of the month also.
But that doesn't get you Big Ten Network Husky games at this point.
I have the like sports package, but Root Sports isn't part of that.
Oh, it isn't?
Root Sports, you have to have the plus thing. It's not part of the sports package.
Oh.
So I have both right now, I have a package just for the fucking Mariners. I told you about this when the season started.
But I thought it was the same as like the Red Zone package.
It is not. Okay. They are not included in there.
The Comcast, I'm just like, give me everything. I can't miss a basketball game.
Have they figured this out yet, by the way?
No.
Are they even close to it?
I can't
speak to this. USC played on national TV last week. There is a time that there might be a mutiny, right? Because this affects USC, UCLA, UW, and Oregon.
Correct.
This is not like fucking around. These were teams that were...
I feel like Oregon fans are more likely to riot over this than USC
I think we all
fans.
Should, but...
But Oregon just, was previously on, USC wasn't.
Quantity-wise, for USC fans, it is a massive market that they are choosing not to capture. Figure it out. Why are we in the Big Ten?
We thought we were done with all of this.
Anyway, the point that I wanted to make, I don't think we should do any happy talk, extra talk, or whatever.
Post pod.
We can, maybe. I do have to say, every time I hear this name, I think of the song Breakfast at Tiffany's by Deep Blue Something.
Oh.
Easily one of the greatest songs ever made.
I mean, every time I think to myself, it's like, Cookies with Tiffany, to the tune of that song.
Oh,
yeah,
what about
you can't,
Cookies with Tiffany?
You can't help but do it.
I think we are the only people who care about this song.
We'll see.
If other people care
we
about it.
We will see on the Discord whether anyone else cares. Or peltoncast@gmail.com.
There's certain songs where you're just like, that song. Look, I don't know any other Deep Blue Something songs. Where you're like, how did they do it? Seriously. How did these human beings...
It's like how Michigan State made the college football playoff.
No, but Michigan State didn't make the college football playoff.
I know. That's the joke.
But Deep Blue Something actually wrote this song about both kind of liking the movie Breakfast at Tiffany's was the one thing that they had. Nobody is thinking of that.
I never understood what the lyrics actually were talking about until recently. I don't remember, but like...
It's pretty clear, and as I recall, I think we both kind of liked it.
I'm not really paying as close attention to the Breakfast at Tiffany's.
It's the most important. You literally, why else would you like the song if you're not listening to lyrics?
To just sing the part, I said, what about Breakfast at Tiffany's?
I said, what?
I remember both kind of liked it. But I don't know the context of we both kind of liked it.
At least that's the one thing we've got. But you've got Common People by Pulp. Just has to be huge. You know what I mean? Right? Like, you're like, you wrote that song, Jarvis Cocker. You're like, you wrote that song. It is necessary that it is massive. To have come up with this idea for this song. Maybe Teenage Dirtbag. I'm going to throw that in there. And then we have Deep Blue Something. Songs where you're just like, I can't believe the achievement that these human beings pulled off by making this.
So is this a list of one-hit wonders? Or
no.
Is the idea because certain songs
Pulp
aren't
a one-hit wonder? It's just the concept for the song.
I see. The high-mindedness?
Yes. That a human being, and but it's not like a joke song, right? Like there are joke songs that have absurd concepts. I mean, I will say Fountains of Wayne, Stacy's Mom, got it going on. You're just like, God, fucking nailed it on that one.
I would say Spirit in the Sky, which is meaningful enough to Jan that she wants it played at her funeral.
There are other songs like this, but you're just like high concept enough, unique concept enough. Anytime I hear about somebody's mom, I'm just like, they've got it going on.
Fair.
The Boy's Mine?
No.
Is that what you're going to go with?
No, Looking Glass. Brandy, You're a Fine Girl.
Oh, exactly. Like, literally nobody else in pop music is talking. And The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. There's just
a good
not
one.
That many songs where people are talking about their life, their love, and their ladies, the sea.
Very true. If if there's a restaurant, My Life, My Love, and My Lady, that's all I'll think of or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Or a restaurant called The Sea.
Yes.
I'd be like, every time, we'd be like, My Life, My Love, My Lady. There are other songs that I love for different reasons, right? In the sort of like pop rock genre. But like Dancing in the Moonlight, love that song.
Ooh.
But I don't think that's such a unique concept that it needed to be massive. But you write a pop song about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald or about how you both kind of liking Breakfast at Tiffany's and that's the one thing you've got. Thank you, Deep Blue Something.
I mean, so I feel like I read this recently that originally it was about a different movie and they changed it to Breakfast at Tiffany's because Breakfast at Tiffany's just is like so much more quotable.
I have never once seen Breakfast at Tiffany's. My only Me impression neither. Of it is just the Katharine Hepburn in it. Like I can see the image of it. That's right. Everything I know. Never
the
read
iconic
the book.
Image.
And I believe that George Costanza on Seinfeld went and watched it with the family.
Let me see if we can find this. Oh, yeah. The lyrics of the song were inspired by Audrey Hepburn's performance in the feature film Roman Holiday.
Oh, did I say Katharine Hepburn? Is it Audrey Hepburn?
I don't specifically remember that you said Katharine, but I don't remember that you don't. I'm not going to check.
Okay.
But he thought the Hepburn film Breakfast at Tiffany's would make a better song title. And 100% true.
Oh, my God. If it's... What was the other movie? Roman Holiday?
Yeah.
Yeah. If it was Roman Holiday, we don't know what the fuck Deep Blue Something are.
Obviously,
and
we already...
care deeply about Deep Blue Something.
We already associate the word holiday anytime you hear that with the song Holiday Road by Lindsay Buckingham.
Of course. Anyway. Also, you know you have a great band when their top three songs are the same song on Spotify. Nothing else over a million plays. They just nailed it.
They did. 100%.
And here we are on a song from 1995. We're talking about a cookie place.
One quick update before we get to the takes, which we don't have takes this week. Get to the Mariners. The question came up in the Discord. What's going on with NBA expansion? And next Tuesday will be the NBA's fall preseason Board of Governors meetings. So more than likely... we would expect to hear something more advancing the ball on expansion coming out of that where they would probably discuss
it. Pun intended?
No.
At least that's the one thing we've got.
Advancing the ball would be more of a football analogy anyway. So, and Adam Silver will surely be asked about it afterwards. So expect a little more by the time we next record, assuming we do it on Tuesday. All right, as I said, no takes this week. It's been retired now that we're into football season and now that the Mariners' playoff odds have dwindled down to 6%.
I want to say one more thing about the Huskies. 4th and 5, the Weber State 39, first drive of the game. Will Rogers pass incomplete. They didn't pick up the fourth down. But the willingness to go for that fourth down on the first drive, 4th and 5, they're kind of in no man's land, but it's not a gimme. There are other coaches who would have, Chris Peterson would have seen that as a great moment to quick punt.
Yes, he would have. Yeah, but no, I liked it.
There weren't a lot of other decisions like that, but overall, you know, this 4th and 14 was when they punted there, and yeah, 4th and 10 at the 44 was kind of a pretty obvious punt situation. But making that decision was like, that's great.
Christian Capel wrote in his piece about that, about the fourth down decision making, and noted that the Arizona did not actually go for a lot of fourth downs last season, but they punted very infrequently, which matched up with the research that I did back when the Huskies hired Jed Fish about the rate of going for it in likely go situations was actually quite high, above average
they
last year.
They just scored points.
Yeah, they just faced an unusually low number of typical go situations. So
I wonder if that's something about the Jed Fish offense.
I think it's probably a sample size more than anything. They don't play that many games. So the Mariners, any thoughts on their demise besides that you're not planning to set foot in T-Mobile Park again this season?
No.
They have been notably unlucky throughout the stretch of this AL West collapse, culminating in, was it 3 consecutive walk-off games against them on this road trip by the Angels and A's? I think it was 3 consecutive. And then they padded the run differential. This is the very opposite of the fun differential season, where the Mariners now have a solidly above 500 run differential and a terrible fun differential. But I will say, you know what I can you say about a team that is 70-70 after they were previously 69-69?
What?
Totally neutral. That's your Seattle Mariners. Totally neutral. So we'll see if they get completely knocked out of it, whether we see some players start to get shut down for the season. But nice to see Julio hitting a little better lately. That is a reason for optimism going into 2025, the likelihood of Julio playing better. Wow, you are so far out. You know, that's the thing about being neutral is you don't get as down on a team as you are on the Mariners right now. Just stay even keel.
There's nothing neutral about my relationship to the Seattle Mariners. I hate them more than anything. We can sit here and talk about the Mariners or whatever, but it's just like every win is bad at this point. I will. The worst part about it is there's a little part of me in the back of my mind that's like, if they just, I mean, they need to go on like a 20 game win streak right now, but
they almost did that last year, didn't they? Or did they? I forget.
Not
how many
in September.
Games.
They didn't, but well, like shit in September.
I'm aware of what happened in September. I was at some of those games. We were at the good game, actually.
I was at the bad one earlier that week. So
you just go to a lot more Mariners games than I do.
I hate them though. I hate them on a personal level. It's incredible how much they have made me. Like, I saw Dan Wilson. I was at Virginia Mason yesterday, and they were talking about, like, Virginia Mason is the like the hospital that athletes trust or whatever, and they had Dan Wilson as a Mariner in there. And I hate Dan Wilson now. They've made Randy Arozarena unlikable. The Mariners are a poisonous franchise, and everything they touch turns to crap.
Okay. Well, moving on to the roundup. Kraken announced that rookie camp will start next Thursday with full training camp beginning a week later. So that is on the horizon. Seattle Sounders. A 1-0 loss Saturday against the hated rival Portland Timbers. This is a case where the Mariners are down and the Sounders are not up at this moment in the standings, although still looking good for the playoffs. Stefan Fry left this one in the 5th minute with a concussion while saving a point-blank shot from Portland's Mason Toy. Andrew Thomas came in to replace him after playing well throughout their Leagues Cup and U.S. Open Cup runs. Juan Mascara scored the game's lone goal in the 55th minute. Sounders had 13 shots, 5 on goal, but couldn't crack what is typically a porous Timbers defense. Portland did have an XG advantage, 1.4, 2.9, so a deserved victory for them. One positive note, Cote d'Ivoire winger Georgi Minunogu, who signed a first-team contract last week, played 40 minutes off the bench, played well. He had previously played 5 matches on short-term contracts while part of the Tacoma Defiance. The outcome allowed the Timbers to move into a 3-way tie with the Sounders in Houston for 6th in the West. Sounders would currently finish last among that group by virtue of goal differential. That makes it all the more important to get a point on the road this week. However, they're going up against Columbus in a rematch of the 2020 MLS Cup Final. The Crew, second only to Miami with 1.96 points per match this season, have an MLS best plus 28 goal differential. The news happier last weekend for the Seattle Reign, who made it 2 wins on the trot, winning at Louisville with a pair of comebacks on Saturday. They trailed 1-0 and 2-1, but answered both times with a Sofia Huerta penalty and a Jisoo Yoon goal. And then an own goal in the 81st minute gave the Reign their first lead, and the lead that produced the final 3-2 margin is the first road win for Seattle Reign all season.
Yikes.
They're up to 11th in the NWSL standings. Do have a chance to get within a point of 9th place Angel City with a road win this Friday. So, Reign, you're telling me there's a chance. Seattle Storm. We recorded last Wednesday after they had beaten Atlanta. Subsequent to that game, it was a brutal 4-game stretch that they entered into. All 4 of those games against the top 2 teams in the WNBA standings coming in, the New York Liberty and Connecticut Sun. Friday night in the finale of the homestand. Really good first half for the Storm offensively, but faded in the second half somewhat predictably, and New York pulled away to get the victory in that one. Sunday in Connecticut, after making the long flight out there, and for an early tip-off, 10 a.m. Pacific time, the offense really couldn't get a lot going. Storm managed to hang around. It was a close game, but couldn't get over the hump down the stretch. It is Connecticut. Got that victory. Tuesday was a rematch at Mohegan Sun Arena of those same 2 teams. And this time, despite starting the game in an 8-0 hole, Storm rallied, kind of got back into it late in the first half, took the lead in the second half, and were able to pay that off. What was ultimately, I think, perhaps their best win of the season.
Okay.
When you consider, so they actually had 3 wins. If you look at this top group of 5 teams in the WNBA standings, they had beaten Vegas early in the season when Chelsea Gray was out, had beaten Minnesota when Nafisa Collier was out at home, and then had beaten Connecticut previously in June at Climate Pledge Arena, a game that I was at but remember almost nothing about. But doing this on the road and against a better Sun team, because they've added Marina Mabry at the trade or before the trade deadline, and you know she's really strengthened them coming out of the Olympic break. I do think, in given that context, this was their best win of the season.
All right. I mean, they kind of needed it right now.
Absolutely.
Basically, this stretch of these four games, they needed to at least split them.
Well, that's still going to require them to win at New York on Thursday.
Exactly, but they're in a position that they can now.
It is plausible.
I was feeling very down about what the Storm had done recently after those two losses, and it kind of felt like, I don't know, it just felt like as football season started, all of the other things we were paying attention to kind of were, like when you talk about the Sounders, I'm just like, man, it is really, it's hard to compete anyway for MLS that it stretches into when the NFL and college football are happening. And maybe this is just for us, but I feel like college football has become a bigger sport than it's ever been. And maybe that's because the Huskies are good or whatever, but like,
I do feel like it's more in the popular consciousness right now.
The
not for me personally.
I mean, I watched tons of college football. Like,
I watched the Husky game.
That's wild. Florida State on, I guess, Monday night, the USC LSU game. It felt like watching an NFL game. It was an amazing game to watch.
It sounded fun.
I thought you were giving me a, like, are you kidding me look?
No.
No, it was awesome. I loved every second of it. Your argument of basically if college football is like, if college football is just NFL with worse players, why do we want that? And the answer is, we want more NFL. We want the NFL on Saturdays too.
That's a fair point. You raise fair points. You know they're encroaching into Friday now.
Oh, yeah. Bring it on. I'm for it. Friday from Brazil? You think I'm not with that? Anyway,
the pressure was on the Storm.
College football is a long stretch. But to all these teams, Sounders were looking very bad. The Storm were looking bad. The Mariners season is over, and I hate them. One
might say swoon.
The rain, but it's not a swoon because it requires all of the teams. And it was sort of just like the teams that we were paying attention to over the summer as we started moving toward the fall, best season in all of the year. Things were looking a little bit worse. But this win that they had against the Sun really kind of salvaged things for the Storm. There is a chance now that this isn't going to be a completely, like, it's not a wasted season, but if you're talking about if the ultimate goal is to win a championship, this is their best chance to do that is probably this season.
With this group?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
with this group, but also looking around the WNBA, all these other teams are getting better. And the Storm don't have young players like most of the other teams in the league have.
I mean, Izzy Magbegor is still pretty young. What I will say is, like, to your point about there is no such thing as team building in the transfer portal era, every single player in the WNBA who is not on a rookie contract will be every single important player will be a free agent in 2026.
Yes.
So it's going to be a complete free-for-all.
I think this was the right way to do things, and I think that the Storm trying to win right now will help them win more in the future. They're kind of...
It is interesting because maybe this was their best year in free agency because they had such an advantage in terms of facilities, and other teams now are scrambling to build their own practice facilities to keep up.
There's still a history and an infrastructure, though. If you had to rank most important WNBA franchises...
I mean, I was looking at it yesterday, like all time, because they mentioned that... Phoenix was touting that by making the playoffs, and the Storm clinched a playoff berth last Friday despite the loss.
Okay.
It was the 18th all-time playoffs berth in Phoenix history, and I was like, that's not really that good when you've played from the beginning, in their case, 28 seasons in a league where, you know, typically two-thirds of the teams have made the playoffs, and that will change a little bit. Because one of the things I didn't mention, by the way, WNBA expansion coming to Portland.
Hello.
That's not official yet, but my buddy Sean Hyken of Rip City Report.
Coming back to Portland.
Coming back to Portland. Yes, that is accurate. I was there. I saw at least one, probably two Fire games back in 2000.
Do we have a name yet? Do we know?
Or in 2002. No, we're not that far away. Rose Garden Report is Sean's excellent Substack. So
That's what is exciting. Expansion right now on the horizon for the WNBA?
So 2025, we're going to get the Golden State Valkyries.
Okay.
2026, we'll get the Toronto team, and that's when the Portland team would also begin playing.
26. So this is soon.
Yes.
And they're not changing the amount of playoff teams, as far as we know.
We'll see.
But so if you had to basically like consider a pool of the most important WNBA franchises, it's New York and Vegas and the Sparks and probably the Storm.
Minnesota. Minnesota's the other team that has... Minnesota and Houston are the other two teams that have four championships besides the Storm.
Do you think Minnesota is that important of a franchise, though? And draws free agents the way that the Storm do?
They don't.
That's what I'm saying. Like, they kind of need to stay good to be one of those teams.
Yeah. No, I agree with that.
And that's how you, in a year in 2026... If everybody is going to be a free agent, if every single player across the league is going to be a free agent, being a really bad team for those couple of seasons heading into that makes it more difficult.
So, anyways, for the Storm, I wasn't quite sure whether they counted this season already or not. Yeah, this is the 18th playoff appearance as well for the Storm, but they started 3 years after the Mercury.
Yeah, Mercury.
So... A more impressive ratio. Los Angeles with 20 out of 28, the only team that has made the playoffs more frequently than the Storm.
Okay, so where do they sit right now heading toward the fourth of that gauntlet of games?
So they're still a game back of Las Vegas for the fourth and final home court advantage spot in the WNBA standings. Also keeping an eye on Indiana. 2.5 games back, but close and fast. They have won 5 consecutive games.
Is it Caitlin Clark has figured it out, or have they just figured it out overall?
It's not just Caitlin Clark, because Kelsey Mitchell and Aaliyah Boston have also been playing at a top 10 level for the last couple of months.
That's what
here.
I'm saying. It's like there are teams coming.
I don't disagree.
Caitlin Clark's going to be a free agent in 2026, though?
No, she'll be under contract.
Okay. What do you mean everybody in the league then?
So all not the veterans. None literate. Of the veterans are going to sign contracts for more than 1 year this offseason.
Okay.
Who are free agents, because the cap is going to go up in 2026.
Massively.
Yes. And so everyone will want to be a free agent then.
I mean, this is a fun time to, but I just worry a little bit. Again, people are worried all the time. I don't actually care. I think there is a.
I believe that's called concern trolling.
There is a place that, similar to the Sounders, where they had a huge head start, but you have to be able to kind of build on it. And that being in Seattle, where you're a secondary market, it's difficult. You kind of need to be above and beyond. And as these other teams are coming, that Golden State team is going to be an exciting franchise.
Without question.
That Toronto team is going to be an exciting franchise. And it's going to happen instantly. Whether they're good or not, the people of Toronto want that team there.
I think it's going to be less appealing to free agents than Golden State, a team in the Bay Area, is.
But those are both important franchises coming in.
I do think that, yes, there's a chance that this round of WNBA expansion serves much like when MLS expanded to the Northwest cities, and all of a sudden, like, the game leveled up in terms of fan support.
Yeah.
So, it's an interesting time. I mean, I think the answer is not, you have to do this. It's just, it's no longer realistic to be as dominant as the Sounders were fan-wise throughout their
history. But that also, to me,
results-wise.
It's sort of a double-edged sword of like how they could have approached this offseason. Obviously, you know, the Storm didn't have an Oracle or whatever, but like not having Angel Reese on the roster. Angel Reese is an exciting player to play with for free agents.
I think so, yeah.
And they made a choice to not draft him. They knew that she was going to be there.
They didn't know for sure, but I think they could have reasonably expected she would be there.
And they made a choice to basically be good this year. It might pay off, though. It might pay off.
They still got that 2026 LA pick.
It might pay off because of that, and it also might pay off just because of being good enough might help them in free agency long term.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting way to thread things, but having young superstars, they're going to be harder to get. It's going to be more similar to the NBA as more teams join.
By definition, yes.
And it's going to be harder to sign free agents. Like the Storm are heading toward, and it's not going to be the same for New York and Vegas. In my opinion.
We'll see what happens with Vegas.
It gets harder for everybody, but Vegas is a unique franchise.
Well, they're a unique franchise in part because of their ability to retain their stars on seemingly below market contract extensions, which come in the context of the Aces repeatedly getting investigated for improper benefits to their players, which A is like, when the cap goes up, you don't
need to do that as
much. The players just make the money.
Yeah.
We have it. We know the model for it. It's called NIL. But New York is always going to be New York. In Vegas, certainly the support of the organization.
That's what I'm saying. Still, but also there, being in Vegas is a unique thing. Even if there are more teams in Vegas, the more teams that there are in Vegas, it doesn't necessarily dilute the Aces.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see on that one.
Okay, well, let's talk about football.
The Storm, they do, like we said, finish the road trip Thursday against the Liberty, then back home to host Phoenix on Saturday night. What might be Diana Taurasi's last visit of her WNBA career. We'll see what her plans are going forward. Okay, UW football, we talked about it earlier, Saturday, Eastern Michigan, 12:30 kickoff on Big Ten Network. We'll see whether you can watch it in the Seattle area or not. Huskies, 23.5-point favorites in this game. Let's do the nose update before this. We mentioned Quinton Moore left the game with a leg injury. Apparently not as serious, thankfully, as it looked, as he was unable to put any weight on it coming off the field. Jed Fish said Monday he expects Moore will miss a couple of weeks at most. Haven't gotten an update since then after Moore's been evaluated, but will on Thursday very likely. That's good news with just two scholarship players currently healthy at tight end, Kalecki Latu and true freshman DeGraff, who, as you mentioned, caught a touchdown pass on his first play.
That was
from
his first play on the field. It's only going down from here, Decker DeGraff. Sorry. True. That's awesome.
We learned Saturday that fellow freshman Charlie Cowell suffered a season-ending injury during fall practice. Ryan Otten still not expected to start practicing for a few weeks.
Ugh.
I know. One thing we also should mention, we didn't at the top, Cam Davis coming back from his injury to be productive, caught a pass coming out of the backfield with a lot of space.
He the one who set up the second touchdown?
I think so.
Okay, I was off looking for things.
Not cookies with Tiffany, but other things.
Pacing with Katie.
So that was just awesome to see after he was out all of last season. Eastern Michigan. The directional Michigan school, coming off a 6-7 season, a lopsided loss in the 68 Ventures Bowl, which is a thing, to South Alabama. 2 years ago, they went 9-4 with a win in the famous Idaho Potato Bowl, both the most wins in the first bowl win for Eastern Michigan since 1987.
Really?
Their longtime coach, Chris Creighton, in his 12th year now at the helm. They beat UMass 28-14 in the season opener, behind 241 yards from transfer Cole Snyder, a six-year senior who began his career as a backup at Rutgers, started for Buffalo the last two seasons, both passed and ran for a TD in his Eagles debut. They also have a six-year running back in Delbert Mims, who had 12 carries for 60 yards in his debut after 5 years as a backup at North Carolina State. Sophomore Dante McMillan got 15 carries after totaling just 11 in his entire freshman season, but for just 54 yards. JC transfer Oren Singleton had 89 yards on 8 catches, the only receiving touchdown. Michigan State transfer Terry Lockett Jr. had 80 yards. Wisconsin transfer Marcus Allen, 61 on 3 catches. This is what if they made the whole team out of transfers?
I mean, that's kind of how it goes for a lot of these programs.
It is, yes. The defense, the thing that stood out here, they had 6 sacks with 4 different players recording at least one of those. Now, UMass, it should be noted, ranked 127th in FBI last year.
If you were Oregon, you'd argue that they were a pretty good team. One of the best.
But that's only one spot behind where Michigan was last year. So it does appear that they have improved this season.
I mean, it's kind of similar to Weber State. It's hard to judge this. I mean, I guess, have they generally been better offensively or defensively last year?
Oh, that's a great question.
That's a good question. Somebody must know the answer to. We're going to learn things about the Husky football team in this game.
But I think much like with Weber State, it's going to be less about the opponent and more about the process.
But there are teams, again, who've played close games, and we just want to make sure that doesn't happen.
Correct.
And if it is a comfortable victory, I think the thing to me that I'm most excited about, obviously, again, any opportunity to see Jonah Coleman play, I am in on. Even Adam Muhammad too, though. And yet
you didn't go to the open fall practices.
I mean, it's different.
I know.
It was funny also, I was saying to you, when the Seahawks drafted Devin Witherspoon and I watched him for the first time ever, and I was just like, oh yeah, that's my favorite player.
Yep.
It's not even close. Ephesians Pry Sock. Instantly favorite Husky.
So, he's pretty awesome.
seeing Ephesians Prysock play, that to me is the thing.
I got to explain to a baby fantasy genius the book of Ephesians.
He was talking the next day about how much he hated it.
Oh no, he was.
Yeah, he's like Al, Uncle Al kept going on and on and on about the book of Ephesians.
Did I?
Yeah. Well. That's how he heard it. But actually,
that was his low point of the game.
Yeah, I think that was it. Wow. The lowest point was.
Wasn't even the spoons for the Frozen Limited.
I think I'm actually most excited to see this Husky defense, though.
Yeah.
Because if they have another performance like this, I mean, we kind of know what Will Rogers is. I think we kind of know what a lot of the offensive players are. Seeing the Jedfish offense work is exciting, but this Husky defense is. I'm just, again, still curious. If they do it again against Eastern Michigan, things become more real the more times that you see them. So I think that's what I'm most excited to see in this game is what they look like if they are dominant again and if they are, you know, hold, what was the quarterback's name again? Cole Snyder. If they hold
Cole Snyder, by the way, definitely sounds like a utility outfielder in the 80s.
Oh, yeah. I feel like he's on the Expos.
I have one of his Topps cards.
I'm most excited to see the defense and how things fare after, but
okay,
and to leave the stadium hopefully early because it's going to be hot and you can roast at these games.
Percentage chances of victory
at 95%.
I'm gonna say, yeah, 93.
Okay. If they lose, you'll be telling me about that 2%. Like, I called it.
So it'll be a doubleheader for you this weekend.
Oh, yeah. It'll be a tripleheader with Mateo's football game.
What time is Mateo's football game?
It's actually a practice. It's the first practice of the season in the morning on Sunday.
Okay.
But I'm telling you, these Bills, we were running the whole team back. We're getting after.
Are you coaching? Is there a coach's corner next week?
It will just be practice, so probably not.
Okay.
And then I'm missing the following week. We're missing week one of the season. I actually heard about somebody. I had a coworker who was like, I have a wedding to go to. I was like, first off, she's from New York. And I was like, we have an important conversation to have. And I was like, which team from New York should I be cheering for? Cause she's neutral on the Jets and the Giants. Fan of football in general, neutral on the Jets and the Giants. And
is I was that like, allowed?
I feel like you got to kind of pick one. We'll see. Still neutral on that. But then she was like, I'm going to a wedding Sunday afternoon. And I was like, it is criminal to have a wedding on a Sunday, week one of the NFL season.
It's a choice.
I couldn't even imagine it. Do you remember the worst moment of my life for going to baptism classes? Week one of the NFL season. It's just like, if you can imagine the most abhorrent thing for me to do and have it happen against one of the best days of the year. I'm always bummed that when the Seahawks play at home in week one.
That was the morning that RG3 debuted in.
Adrian Peterson has a monster game. That's all I remember. Adrian Peterson had like three touchdowns.
I want to say they played in the Superdome against the Saints. I vividly remember watching Red Zone.
Yeah, remember watching Red Zone. I remember filling out a piece of paper about a tree or whatever.
Yes. We also delayed watching. We watched the Seahawks, the Russell Wilson's debut on tape delay because of the Carcino Olympics. You're forgetting about the Carcino Olympics.
Wow. And the same day I went to fucking baptism classes and we had the Carcino Olympics and it was Russell Wilson's debut against the Cardinals, which they lost.
A lot was going on.
Wow.
In that one.
What a day.
Yes, they did play at the New Orleans Saints, won 42-32 the Washington.
So that was rookie RG3, put up 40 points.
19 of 26 for 320 yards and two touchdowns, 9 carries for 42 yards. I assume they were running the read option and just like, what is this? Was that coming off the heels? No, there must have been seasons in between after the RG3 game against the Nick Holt UW. Was it the Nick Holt era UW defense?
I think that was his last game.
Oh, now I'm very curious. I need to go look this up as well. So fill the air.
I feel like Nick Holt was gone, I want to say. But that was one of the most fun games to watch.
It was just an incredibly wild game. That was the 2011 season.
I'm pretty sure that was his last game at Baylor.
Well, if it was the 2011 season, then yes, it was his last game at Baylor. They won 67-56.
Oh, my God.
I don't know for sure whether it was the Nick Holt era. We'd have to do some more research on that one. Do you want to put in... Well, he did not throw for as many yards as you would think. But he was 24 of 33 for 295 yards and a touchdown. Terrence Gannaway, who I believe played for the Cowboys for a while, 21 carries for 200 yards.
It was Nick Holt.
Jared Salubi, 5 carries for 101 yards. Someone named Tevin Reese had 2 carries for 101 yards.
2 carries for 101 yards?
Yeah.
That was that kind of game.
They ran for 482 yards and finished with 777 as a team. The Huskies, led by Keith Price, threw for 438 yards in that loss.
Okay, so this Eastern team was obviously good that they played in that season, but that's kind of the standards of what we're talking about. When I look at them playing against Weber State and Eastern Michigan, it's like they beat Eastern Washington by 3. They beat Hawaii by 8 that year. Like, having a comfortable victory against anybody is a good place to be.
Well, let's see if the Seahawks can get a comfortable win to begin the Mike McDonald era against a familiar foe, the Denver Broncos and Bo Nix.
I can't wait.
So the Broncos went 8-9 in Sean Payton's first season. They pulled the plug on the Russell Wilson era after their Christmas Eve loss to the Patriots at home, all but ended their playoff hopes, then waived Wilson in March, taking a historic $53 million dead cap hit. Jarrett Stidham started the last two games after Wilson was benched, went 1-1, albeit with a 31 QBR. And then the Broncos drafted Nix with the 12th pick and then traded for Zach Wilson, just as a little bit of extra cherry on top. Nix in the preseason completed 23 of 30 passes for 205 yards and 2 touchdowns to win the starting job. Wilson was the best overall QB with a 9.0 yards per attempt, 3 touchdowns on 44 pass attempts, although he took 6 sacks and Nix none. Stidham still listed as the backup on the depth chart with Zach Wilson as QB3.
So they kept all three.
They have kept... many teams are keeping 3 quarterbacks. The Seahawks are somewhat the exception because they're... I forget exactly what the new rules are in terms of emergency QBs, but there are some different ones in terms of having those players not dress but not count against the roster limit or whatever, the 53-man.
The league just doesn't need to see, like, kickers and punters and wide receivers playing quarterback.
The NFC Championship game where the 49ers ran out of quarterbacks, I think, was a bit of a tipping point in that regard. They've got a different look at wide receiver around Cortland Sutton. They traded Jerry Jeudy to Cleveland, where he's on one of my fantasy teams, and waived Tim Patrick after his pair of season-ending injuries. 2023 second-round pick Marvin Mims in free agent addition Josh Reynolds expected to start alongside Sutton. They also drafted, you'll recall, Nix's security blanket, Troy Franklin, who put up some monster numbers at Oregon playing with Nix. Javonte Williams remains the starter at running back. They had a pretty average running game last season. The Broncos' defense was kind of interesting. One of the stories of 2023 on a micro level, their defense ranked 25th in EPA per play overall, but they were 6th after their disastrous 1-4 start, which included the 70-point outing by the Dolphins. They were average in that span defending the pass, but 7th best defending the run. They did lose safety Justin Simmons, waived due to his cap hit. But bring back the core of that defense, including Patrick Surtain II, who agreed to the biggest extension ever for a defensive back, 4 years and $96 million in terms of average salary per year on Wednesday. Two guys to watch, young pass rushers Jonathan Cooper and Nick Bonito, who both had at least 8 sacks last season, giving them a decent set of edge rushers. So the Seahawks are 5-point favorites in this game.
I think that feels about right. I mean, this is a rookie quarterback starting his first game on the road. Like,
right.
That it would be strange for them not to be that big of favorites. I am very excited about seeing Bo Nix against the Seahawks defense.
It's going to be, like, obviously we're going to need more data points in just one week to separate what is Bo Nix and what is the Seahawks defense. But we are going to get an initial impression on both of those things.
I can't wait for it. And I'm especially excited about Mike McDonald's defense. I think it's just going to look a little different than Bo Nix saw in college, especially in the Pac-12. I mean, he played against like not a good UW defense a couple of times. The most important games that they played were a Pac-12 schedule. I mean, we're talking like the USC defense last year, the UW defense twice, and Liberty in their bowl game. Obviously, Bo Nix played a lot at college, but it's a radically different situation when all of a sudden you have Mike McDonald on the other side as head coach and calling those plays, and the kind of talent, the defensive line of the Big Cat, the defensive line that the Seahawks are going to field, and the secondary with Reek Woolen, Devin Witherspoon, Julian Love. I think it is going to be a very big wake-up call for Bo Nix and the Denver Broncos. Even good quarterbacks in their rookie seasons, if they're not, you know, the small handful have been very good. Like, it's a difficult go. So coming into this city with his pedigree and where he was, you know, he was drafted 12, but he could have easily been a second or third round pick.
Part of the run on quarterbacks, which also included Michael Penix Jr. at the top of the draft.
I can't freaking wait to see this.
I mean, Nix's stats last year are just preposterous. He had 45 touchdowns and 3 interceptions, completed 77% of his passes. And I do think he was a little bit underrated. It's funny to say about a guy who was the favorite to win the Heisman before the Pac-12 championship game. I think he was a little bit underrated for his role in that relative to the Oregon offensive scheme and their skill position.
You're saying this year? You're saying like this year as people are viewing Oregon or?
No, last year. Even though he was going to win the Heisman, I still think there was like too much skepticism of like, oh, he's just basically, you know, an air raid style offense, which isn't really what they were doing, even though there was a lot of yak. I think
there are some things
like,
that Bo Nix got away with at Oregon that he's not going to get away with in the NFL, though. The scrambling is just, I don't see it happening in the same way. Like, well, he'll pick up a first down running in this game.
Yeah, it'll happen.
But the amount that these defenders are going to hit and be faster than college defenders is going to be different.
I would say my conception of what Bo Nix was at Oregon is similar to what Brock Purdy is for the 49ers, where people, I think, give a little bit too much of the credit to Kyle Shanahan in the weapons and not quite enough to Purdy and Nix in that case.
So are you saying you think that Bo Nix might be good in this game?
But I also don't know how well that's going to translate to the NFL, because so much of Bo Nix's success in college was and granted, everyone was more experienced the last few years because of the COVID years. But, you know, this is someone who is a starting quarterback through nearly 2,000 pass attempts in college. Like, that is just so preposterous. And I think that advantage against college, like, he wasn't very good early in his college career during Auburn.
I think that's why people have kind of dinged Bo Nix also, is it took being at Oregon. I'd be curious to see how close the defenders were to his receivers on passes. And in the NFL, you're not going to have wide open receivers.
So I do think it's going to be a bit of a challenge for him to adapt to the NFL, despite the fact that I think he was an underrated college quarterback.
He's a different kind of quarterback than Michael Penix is, too. Michael Penix did not have wide open receivers all the time. Like, the Oregon offense,
I mean, let's not undersell the Kalen DeBoer, Ryan Grubb offense. He had plenty of open receivers, but
they're only good if I'm spinning it as how good the Seahawks offense is going to be. Rome Odunze is a singular talent. Ryan Grubb is also an amazing offensive coordinator. Michael Penix is a singular talent also. None of these things work in concert with each other, though.
But what you would say is that Penix, like, his arm strength, his ability to make every throw, is different in terms of physical tools than Nix, where it's more based on accuracy and decision
making. See, I think
Penix
is a more accurate quarterback than Bo Nix is. I think Bo Nix was hitting a lot of open receivers because we saw them be wide open.
And still, though, 77% is 77%.
It was
a really big number.
Too easy for Bo Nix at Oregon last year.
I mean, that may make his adjustment somewhat difficult, more difficult.
It's just not going to happen against the Seahawks team.
And the thing we should say is, like, with Russell Wilson, when they were successful last season, Sean Payton, as he did with Drew Brees, it's dialing up a lot of these high percentage completions. Like, This is Drew Brees's, you know, back half of his career when his arm strength wasn't what it was the first half of his career, but he was continually setting new records for completion rate. So it's going to be fascinating to see how this works in the NFL.
I am also confident that another person who's aware of that information is Mike McDonald.
I mean, it's one thing to be aware of it and another thing to stop it. I am optimistic that he's going to be able to stop it.
I mean, Mike McDonald's probably fine with the idea of giving up some of these short completions also.
I agree.
But it's a little bit of a dink and dunk offense. And I'm just not convinced it's going to work. And, you know, we talked about yesterday about Shield's prediction about the Seahawks defense being fifth in the NFL, which, I mean, that's just Shield's prediction. But if they're fifth in the NFL, rookie Bo Nix in his first game on the road is not scoring very many points against them.
And if you want to say that Brock Purdy is the comparison, well, the 49ers did not do notably well against the Ravens and Mike McDonald's defense last year. So
it depends on talent. I mean, this is the kind of game that, again, it's different than UW versus Weber State, because that game was like, okay, we're seeing what this looks like. Obviously, it's brand new, but it's Weber State.
Right.
The Denver Broncos are an NFL team.
Even though they're one of the lowest over-unders, just the spread in talent between, first off, the Seahawks aren't that much higher.
Yeah.
And second off, the spread in talent just isn't nearly as large as it
There's
is.
There's probably a window for the Broncos. They probably can't win the AFC West. I would be shocked if that was the case. But there's a window for the Broncos of worst team in the NFL to the fifth seed in the AFC.
Sure.
Because there's pretty much...
I'd say sixth seed.
There's a window for most teams that's that big in week one. But Bo Nix could be amazing.
Maybe they'll come out and look like Ryan RG3 in the Shanahan's.
And their coach is still Sean Payton, who's done this before. So if the Seahawks look good in this game and it is a comfortable victory and the defense looks very good, I think we should just assume that the defense is good. I don't think we should... Whatever happens in this game against the Broncos, I think will be what the Seahawks are.
I don't think we should assume that for a variety of reasons, including sample size. But I don't think it's like, you know, an asterisk beside the performance.
It's not the Weber State game at the very least.
Yeah.
Offensively, I feel like we, again, kind of know what it's going to look like because...
But you know what I'm excited about is just more drives. This is the thing I really hadn't thought about until I heard a discussion of it in fantasy and the implications for the Seahawks. Like, they ran so few offensive plays the last few years, in part because of their own low and third down percentages, which we talked about a little bit with Ben, but also because the defense just could not get off the field. And even against an offense like this, I still think they're going to be more successful in limiting opponent plays because they couldn't possibly not be.
Uh-huh. We kind of dealt with, like, not the worst kind of football because the offense was pretty good for the last couple of years.
But it's certainly a very frustrating type of football.
It also means that every series mattered so much.
Right.
And I think, I don't know. I'm just excited about, again, love Pete Carroll. I'll be sad to have a Seahawks team coached by not Pete Carroll. But I'm very excited about, on the flip side, you know, the way that people are having conversations about how much Mike McDonald cares about, you know, stats or whatever. You talked about them beefing up the stats department or his instincts lining up with stats. I think that's kind of bullshit because people are aware of stats. Mike McDonald is aware of how statistically minded football is played. I don't think he's unaware. So he's making a choice to see that. It's always a choice. Like, if you think Mike McDonald is unaware of how statistical-minded football is played, that is wrong.
I mean, sure, everyone's aware of it. They just lots of people just choose not to do it.
Then that would be his instincts don't line up with it. Like, I don't know if I even believe in this idea of instincts. It might be that Mike McDonald...
I do think it matters to some degree because I had this conversation with someone after Brandon Staley's first season as head coach of the Chargers where they said... Look, I don't think actually his aggressiveness is influenced by analytics as people think. And I was like, well, like he was making the correct choice. Who cares? But the reason it mattered is because his faith in it is, you know, his philosophy was not so rooted in it that the very public, I don't want to say failure, but like bad luck that they had on fourth downs at the end of his first season, combined with the fact that he was no longer as unconfident in his defense the next couple of years, resulted in him no longer making good decisions on fourth downs. Whereas, you know, if I think it was...
Neutral to me.
I have studied this, the fourth downs, this is the way to go. You're more resolute. You're going to be... I think that's more likely to carry over from year to year.
That is probably true, but I think the thing that you want to avoid as a head coach is a dogmatic head coach. And I think that's kind of what Pete Carroll became.
On a lot of things, I think that's true on fourth downs, even with the conversation we had about maybe John Harbaugh not doing it as much because his team was good last year. I want more dogma
within
there.
Within a window, though, right?
Yeah.
There are times that it doesn't make sense, even if it is the right statistical thing to do, right? There are percentages of right and wrong. You know what I mean? Like 51%, if you should go 51% of the time, that's within a window. It's not the same as you should go 100% of the time. Does that make sense?
It does.
There are different kinds of decisions. Pete Carroll at times, it wasn't always, Pete Carroll made some fourth down decisions. Pete Carroll made some very bad fourth down decisions. There are neutral fourth down decisions that Pete Carroll definitely wouldn't even consider. And if you're Mike McDonald and you're going to make the obvious ones and maybe make some of the not obvious ones, that's fine. Because again, it's being within the window of, and for John Harbaugh, he's done it very successfully. John Harbaugh's won a Super Bowl because of it and has maintained a very high level of football for multiple years. But also, John Harbaugh wasn't dogmatic about how football was played. He turned over the offense to look radically different under Lamar Jackson than it did.
That's fair.
And I mean,
in terms of scheme, I do think that.
That is what is important to me right now, is that we're not hearing from Mike McDonald to like, this is how we're going to do things. It's going to be X. Maybe they're going to be playing aggressive or whatever. And just like, sure. You know, that's not a scheme, but he's not like, we're going to do this thing. Even the running the ball, like if they're going to start from the run, a run, like the Niners offense is about running, right? We all would be happy with the Niners offense, but the Niners offense is opened up because of running the ball. And similar to even like the Oregon offense, running is not inherently bad. The way that Pete Carroll ran was bad.
You and I differ somewhat on this. I am much more of the philosophy that even the best running offenses are still not as efficient as good passing offense. But the bigger thing is, I don't care what any coaches say during interviews. Actions over words, 100%. So we don't know that much yet about Mike McDonald's philosophy, and we will start to learn more on Sunday. And we'll learn more over the course of hopefully several years as coach of the Seahawks.
I totally agree.
Some relatively good news, I think, on the injury front. Just two players for the Seahawks did not practice on Wednesday, which was the first day they had to release an injury report. That was Pharaoh Brown and then Uchenna Nwosu. It would be very surprising, I think, if Nwosu was able to make it back for week one. Noah Fant, Tyler Lockett, Rayshon Jenkins, and Dre Jones were limited. Seems likely at this point that they should be available, but we will see more of that. Fant may be the biggest question mark. We'll see, but you know, certainly nobody, no surprises on there, I guess.
I still need to come back to this. I wanted to see, I mean, the Niners, DVOA is so complicated to find now. The Niners DVOA was good offensively.
Yeah, but the Niners DVOA is so good because of their so good passing. Now, your argument, I think, would be that a lot of that success is predicated on the play action that their running game sets up. And I would note, Bill Barnwell had a good piece about this.
It's not even necessarily the play action. It's about how much motion is involved in the offense also.
I mean, I don't know that motion is correlated with running, though.
You don't think so? It's still part of it.
No.
Motion at the line affects the run as well.
Yeah, I agree. It helps both things. I'm just saying, I don't think you have to run the ball a lot to...
No, I'm not saying you have to. I'm just saying, if you're running the ball without any motion,
I don't know that the Seahawks were necessarily like below average in terms of their use of motion on run plays.
No, the Seahawks offense wasn't... We don't really have that many complaints about the Seahawks offense the last couple of years. The problem was the defense, to be very clear.
We're hopeful for Shane Waldron in Chicago.
Seahawks offense was a problem 3 years ago, 4 years ago, when the defense was relatively okay. They just never found it outside of
what
the...
What is this the period where the defense was relatively okay?
I mean, the sort
I gave
of
you the
late,
stat like at
the
one
late
point
Russell Wilson era
of when was the last time the defense was above average in DVOA.
So this is influenced basically by how good these teams were. Obviously, they ran the ball a lot more, but like the Niners were the third highest run percentage team in the NFL. The Ravens were number one. They were crushing teams in these games, and so you run the ball more because of that. But
and Lamar Jackson running is a factor in the Baltimore offense. When your quarterback can run, it's a totally different equation.
I don't think we can look at it after. It's funny that the Seahawks had one of the lowest run percentages. But again, the defense was quite bad. So a lot of factors go into it. I don't think you just say, if the Seahawks run the ball a lot in this game and win comfortably, that's a great outcome.
Sure. I don't even know how we got here.
I don't either.
Well, that's as good a note as any to, I think, wrap up. I guess we didn't do chances of victory.
Oh, man. 60-73%. I'm going 73%.
Did I catch a niner in there? That's pretty optimistic. I'm going to go 62%.
What does a minus five line, though, imply?
I would need to put together, to run my program to do that, but...
It's a pretty confident line. It has to be one of the higher ones in week one.
I thought it was interesting that it wasn't a half a point. It's just five.
Just five?
Yeah. Let's see. Where is that particular file?
You have a file for this?
I do have a file for
this. Of course you do. This is the happy talk at the end that you have a file for this.
I got a file for a lot of things. It's not actually technically based on the point line. It's based on the, if you're betting the team outright.
Okay. The money in the money line?
Yes.
Okay. How much it pays
out? That is
out?
The word for that I can no longer remember at this stage of the podcast. But where exactly this file exists is tough to say.
The files are in the computer?
Which folder it's in? TBD. Who can say?
I'm not seeing the payout on it. Just the over-under in the spread really quick here.
Anyways.
This might be the biggest line of the weekend.
No way. Right? 5 points?
Oh, there's a Bengals minus 8.5. Bills minus 6.5. ESPN has Seahawks minus 6, for what it's worth. So this is the third biggest line of the weekend.
That's what I was taking it from previously. So it must have changed at some point.
So the sharps are betting the Seahawks.
I guess so.
Which is a great place to be.
I don't know if that necessarily means the sharps are betting them, actually. I agreed with that, but I don't know if it's this.
People, somebody's betting the Seahawks.
All right, the Seahawks are minus 270 on the money line here.
Have you found the program?
I haven't found the program, but I looked up a website that does it. So let me see.
That translates to percentage chances of victory.
Minus 270 says 73%. Wow. So I don't know. You're on the mark.
Does it say 73%?
Okay, that's actually the note to wrap it up on.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Felt like we were kind of on it there. I don't know.